This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Jay Hanselman filling in today for Dan Hurley. It's our weekly news review show, and we have lots to cover today. Ohio House Speaker Cliff Rosenberger is stepping down immediately, moving up a resignation he announced earlier this week amid talk of an FBI investigation into his activities. Joining me from Columbus to discuss Rosenberger's resignation is Cincinnati Enquirer Capital Bureau Chief Chrissy Thompson. You can join the conversation. Our phone number is 513-419-7100 or email us at talk@wvxu.org. We're also on Facebook and Twitter. Again, 513-419-7100. Chrissy, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So, as I said, Speaker Rosenberger had announced earlier this week that he was going to step down on May 1st, and then last night we got a statement that he had moved that up. So what happened to expedite his departure?
Well, there was an awful lot of fellow Republicans saying if the right thing to do is to step down on May 1st, then the right thing to do is also to step down now. He kind of negotiated by making this announcement kind of quicker than anyone thought he would. He resigned on Tuesday night, which was earlier than it seemed like that was going to take place. He was sort of able to dictate his own terms for his exit. And incidentally, he would have, he would have gotten another paycheck had he stayed till May 1st. A lot of folks felt like the Ohio taxpayer shouldn't be paying him if he's not fit to be speaker.
Now, as I recall, this all started a week ago with him hiring an attorney to about a possible investigation by the FBI.
That's right, yes. He has confirmed, and we have also confirmed with people close to the investigation, that he is under investigation by the FBI. They have not talked to him yet. They're talking to other people, which is how he found out that it was happening, and then he hired an attorney. So if they haven't talked to him yet, he is the target of the investigation. And again, that we have confirmed that with sources close to the investigation. So there are several things they're looking at. His lavish lifestyle generally and his cozy relationship with one particular donor. Her name is Ginny Reagan. She's from up here in Delaware County in Columbus. And then also the fact that he used quite a few outside groups to pay for his travel, and one trip in particular is especially a focus of the investigation, and that's a trip that he took to London in last summer. And he took it with several other speakers from around the country. It's paid for by GOPAC, a conservative group. And this group will take donations from businesses, lobbyists, et cetera. And then some folks who donated get to go on the trip. And it appears to be that the focus is on these two Ohio lobbyists for the payday lending industry who were on the trip. And we have photos and such to document that.
With this being out there, was this his decision to step down, or did higher powers above him say, you need to go?
No, I don't know that it had quite gotten to the point that folks were telling him he needed to step down. There had been a sentiment that if this is true, what they're looking at is true, then you need to step down. I think that the decision was between him and his attorney, it didn't sound like it was from, other higher powers, that he was encouraged again to step down if it was true. But it really, honestly, that had basically hardly even been said. He stepped down so quickly. So, I think, all of the questions and the pace of the stories that were already coming, my colleague and I, Jesse Baumert, turned on Monday, a comprehensive review of his travel, and on Tuesday, broke the news that the different areas of the investigation was looking into, and it was only going to escalate from there.
Now, clearly, if he has resigned from the House, stepped down as Speaker, that doesn't necessarily end his problems with the FBI.
No, but it can sometimes be part of an investigation, I'm told, where they will put pressure on you to resign. And they might be more willing to then negotiate with you as far as charges and such, sentencing, that kind of thing goes.
So the House Speaker obviously is in charge of the House. Now that Rosenberger is gone, who takes his place?
Right now, his number two, whose name is Kirk Schering, is taking his place. I believe Kirk is from Canton. Kirk was the guy who handled most of the policy issues that were complicated in the House. Rosenberger was the general leader and kind of the political leader and fundraising leader, and Schering was more of the legislative leader. He will stay in place until probably after the May primary, and then the House is likely, the GOP caucus is likely to hold an election. There are a couple of people who were hoping to be the next speaker. Rosenberger was term limited, so they were hoping to be the next speaker in January. One is Ryan Smith, who is a Rosenberger ally, and then another name that we may remember from the past, Larry Householder. He was past speaker early last decade and also was under investigation by the FBI, although he was never charged.
And I think our State House Bureau had been reporting, wasn't that contest to be speaker in the next term, wasn't that being pretty hotly contested?
Oh, it's a mess, yeah. There is an awful lot of money being spent on both sides. There are certainly factions in the House, and it's just getting even more bitter, even in the last couple of days. So there is a chance that just to try to, first of all, not have, you know, either both sides right now are sort of under a cloud, given Householder's past and then this FBI investigation into Rosenberger. So there's some sort of talk of maybe a third person kind of coming in and being at least a placeholder until January, and then also possibly more of a neutral candidate. So I don't know if that will shape up. I've heard a few folks saying they wish there were someone like that, but thus far it's not clear who that might be.
What are the Democrats saying about all this, or are they saying anything?
Yeah, they're not saying a whole lot. They are, you know, shocked, horrified. They would never do this, et cetera, right? That's what they're saying. But it happened so fast. He stepped down so quickly. Usually the other party starts making noise if it's not dealt with. And, you know, in Ohio, we have, unfortunately, a history where both parties have been under investigation by the FBI and the State House at one time or another. So perhaps there is a sentiment that, we got to stay humble here because this has happened to both sides. The other thing is that Rosenberger, he has, you know, all these ethically questionable things in his past, but he, as a person, was, and as a leader, a lot of people liked him, including the Democrats. They felt that he was easier to work with than some. And so that sentiment has been shared, too, that, like, geez, he was sort of a friend of ours sometimes, you know? So it's been a really busy week, and a lot of people are sort of still in shock.
Cincinnati Enquirer Capitol Bureau Chief Chrissy Thompson talking with us about this week's decision by Ohio House Speaker Cliff Rosenberger to step down. Chrissy, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Again, it's our Friday news review, a busy news week. We have lots to talk about. And joining me now in the studio, we have a WCPO.com, WCPO Insider Politics, and government reporter Paula Christian, Cincinnati Enquirer City Hall reporter Sharon Coolidge, who I'm going to have to call Sherry, so forgive me.
It's fine. Everyone does.
And Cincinnati Business Courier staff reporter and columnist Chris Wetterich. Again, you can join our conversation. The phone number is 513-419-7100 or email talk at wvxu.org. We're also on Facebook and Twitter. Well, one of the topics that we have to talk about is FC Cincinnati. And Chris, you were actually, I think, at the school board meeting on Tuesday evening.
I was.
So anything unexpected? The school board gave their blessing on this land swap for FC Cincinnati to build its proposed stadium where Stargell Stadium is now, and the Western school system would get a new stadium.
They will get a new stadium, and they will, most importantly to them, I think, get all of their what they felt was owed in property taxes, or, you know, to be technical about it, the payments in lieu of taxes that FC Cincinnati will pay them. Over the next, well, forever, basically. So they will get that payment. And they also said that they want to see a community benefits agreement with the West End. Although that is not really required under their agreement, it is required under the city agreement that is going to probably pass on Monday. It's required in the sense that after they pass it, the city is going to allocate, I believe it's in the neighborhood of 30, I can't remember this figure exactly, almost $40 million from the city for this project in order for that money to get paid to FC Cincinnati or get paid to do the infrastructure around the stadium. They will have to do the community benefits agreement with the West End. So anyway, the school board really kind of hung in there with this until the end. They didn't really budge. And it was kind of politically impressive, right? You have some of the most wealthy people in town who own this team. And quite frankly, the business community has paid for the school's levies in recent years. And they basically said, we expect you to pay your taxes. And eventually FC Cincinnati agreed to do that after a lot of, you know, fake deadlines and other gamesmanship that went on. So
was there any surprise that it was a unanimous vote?
I wasn't surprised, and one exception to that is Ryan Messer was absent from there, so I don't know whether he would have voted for it or not. But yeah, it was 6-0, and really this is an interesting thing. They were under, I think, such public pressure both from the pro soccer stadium folks and the anti soccer folks that I think it really kind of brought the board members together in a way that maybe you wouldn't have expected when their term began. I mean, there was a lot of kind of teeth gnashing leading up to this board's inauguration. The the business committee, the Cincinnati Business Committee, had backed certain members, not backed others. This caused some hurt feelings and whatnot, but they really kind of unified there at the end.
So yeah, Ryan has told everybody and tweeted, I believe, that he would have voted for this deal. It really is such an important signal going forward. They held the developer in this case, which is FC Cincinnati, accountable for paying what they're supposed to pay. And, you know, that's really going to be, they're signaling what they're going to do for every other developer that comes down the pike, that they're just going to be like, that, this is what we want. You have to pay, you know, what the agreement calls for. And so, I mean, this is a strong signal that we've not really seen from, I think, the school board before.
And Paula, this now turns to city council, which is hopefully, likely, supposedly going to vote on Monday.
Yeah, I think, well, never say never, but it should pass on Monday. But I wonder if the school board's resolve is one of the reasons why council is taking a harder line with this than they were certainly back in December when it was approved the first time. They're taking a harder line with community benefits agreement. They are, and I think some additional language will be inserted in before they vote on the ordinance, saying no city money will be paid until the community benefits agreement is written and it's signed and the community gets a share of what they want, the $100,000 going towards what the community needs.
What are you hearing this community benefits agreement with the West End? I think there are some who are saying the deal's done. It's too late to do the CBA.
Well, I think that's exactly why we're going to see harder language being inserted in on Monday saying no, because they are getting criticized for that they're rushing this and not letting the community weigh in on what they need. So I do think we'll see harder language in the ordinance before it's passed on Monday.
A little bit of background here. I mean, you know, part of the issue here is as this saga has rolled along, you know, there's been all kinds of talk about CBAs. And one of the things that happened back at the, you know, middle of March was Jeff Birding came out and he said, we're done with the West End. We're moving on to Oakley and Newport. And one of the reasons he stated was because he believed, or I don't quite know how to phrase this, but, you know, he thought that the West End was going to require FC Cincinnati to pay $30 million up front and then another $20 million over a period of time. And, you know, I don't know whether that's posturing or what it was, whether one of the more radical members of the West End Community Council put that out as the figure. But every group that I asked said, no, we didn't give them a number. We didn't give them a number. And so, you know, they came back with $100,000 a year. And that was kind of the ceiling for the school board. But I think it's the floor for the city. The city says you're going to start at $100,000. At least that's how the legislation seems to be shaping up. So you know, we'll see what happens. You know, I think this is going to pass Monday, but the saga will continue on as this CBA is negotiated.
And I think there'll be a lot of discussion Monday. You have to remember the three of these new council members, they were elected in huge on community benefits agreements, especially Tamaya Jamar, Denard, and Greg Landsman. I mean, they are all about the CBA. So this is going to be a real point that we're going to be talking about on Monday.
Tamaya posted on Facebook today, I don't support it for a number of reasons, the least of which is the incredibly insulting $100,000 being given to the community. It's a drop in the bucket compared to the benefit that other organizations derive. And she goes on and on. But, like, she's a hard no, I'd say.
Yeah.
I was getting ready. The school board was 6-0. We don't expect that there will be.
When's the last time we've had a 9-0 vote on anything?
This will not be a 9-0 vote on council.
The question is who's the fifth vote? Is the fifth vote PG? Is the fifth vote Jeff Pastor? It's been shifting around.
Well, isn't it funny? Because everybody wants to be the fifth vote. Everybody wants to be the fifth vote so they can get a little spot at the podium and say, it was all me.
When council members were seeking attention, stop it.
Yes. Never.
But, and it could end up being 6-3.
Who do you think's number six, Jay?
Yeah.
I was thinking Greg Landsman.
No,
I don't see that.
No,
he's a hard no.
Okay.
He's a hard no.
So 5-4 is the best.
That's all they need.
I think it'll be 5-4.
Yeah, I do too.
Don't forget why it's so important. We're having a special council meeting on Monday to really get this, you know, over the hurdle, the goal line. Is that what we're talking about? Soccer?
Yeah.
Because Major League Soccer is meeting on Tuesday in New York, and where the owners could possibly take a vote to give Cincinnati an expansion team. That next chance isn't going to come till August. Mm-hmm. If they're going to be ready to play by the time frame that's been set out, they have got to start right now. In the spring season, we cannot wait until it becomes starts to get cold out again. I don't know, if maybe it's never getting warm again, but still. Anyway, so that's why this vote is super important on Monday.
With this, all this talk about the community benefits agreement, clearly this involves a soccer stadium in FC Cincinnati. Is this something that's going to be pushed in all economic development projects?
I think it will.
And may companies say, I don't want to fool with that.
That's a big fear. That's a huge fear. And one of the criticisms of the council, kind of obliquely from the school board, is that, boy, you guys really haven't really helped us out here. And I think it was important last week and on Friday that Sittenfeld came out with this plan and, you know, started to address this CBA thing. But the council members campaigned on that and they said they wanted to implement it, but they've never really provided any guidance to communities. And I think that probably leads to a situation where you say, I want $30 million up front. And it's kind of like companies are like, no, that's not in our business plan and we're not going to be able to do that. And I think there's going to need to be a reckoning at council over this issue and what is appropriate and what's an appropriate process. Because if you're bringing jobs to, you know, to the city, you don't want to have to pay an additional, you know, amount of money that, you know, isn't in your business plan. So it's going to have to, you're going to have to talk with companies and kind of ease this through.
I think a lot of it too depends on exactly, you know, what kind of impact you're having on the neighborhood. So let's say something like the downtown Kroger, you know, it's a downtown Kroger. There's benefits to a lot of people who live downtown, but it's on its own footprint and it's really not changing the whole scope of downtown. Mm-hmm. But if you look at Children's Hospital, where there was a community benefits agreement, it is going to change the face of Avondale, and this stadium will do the same to the West End. Mm-hmm. So perhaps that would be some sort of guideline of like, we actually are changing your community when we're doing our project.
I mean, they wanted one for Children's. They didn't really introduction of the CBA, they never actually did that.
But there's plenty of things that companies can do.
$11 million, I think.
Besides just paying money. I mean, it's not just money for these companies. They can have training programs. They can have apprenticeships. They can sponsor Little League baseball teams. I mean, these are not necessarily all huge asks for companies that are coming in and getting huge tax breaks from the city and giving these neighborhoods very little.
And some of it actually is free too, right? The
quality
of life things. We're going to turn out the lights at this time. We're going to make sure our fans park here. We won't allow trash to, you know, be strewn around the stadium. So there are some things too that are quality of life things that really don't cost a lot of money.
And that's going to be vital in the West End and then over the Rhine, frankly, too, with all the soccer fans coming down. They're going to want to park for free, and this is Cincinnati, and we want to do that. But
so we don't spend the whole afternoon talking about FC Cincinnati. Yeah. Once they vote on Monday, does this settle it? Can we get this off the front
page?
I
hope so.
No.
Does it come off the front? Does it come off the front page, off the top of the websites?
No, because the MLS decision will be another one, and then when they strike the community benefits agreement, that's another thing.
And an actual development agreement needs to be signed. Yeah, this is absolutely a financing plan we're talking about, and I'm pretty sure every single nail that gets hammered into the stadium will be news.
Yeah.
And also joining us now on the phone is Cincinnati Enquirer reporter Kate Murphy. Kate, good afternoon.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Cincinnati police and others are investigating to find out what went wrong in the death of a 16-year-old boy who became trapped by a minivan bench seat in a school parking lot. His body was found more than 6 hours after he first called 911. Police Chief Elliot Isaac yesterday called Kyle Plush's death a horrific tragedy. City 911 dispatcher was put on leave yesterday as that investigation continues. Kate, can you just kind of walk us through a timeline of what police say happened on Tuesday?
Yeah, absolutely. So around 3 p.m. on Tuesday, Kyle Plush was headed to a tennis match and was trying to get his tennis equipment out of the back of the van when he was pinned by the third row seat as he was kind of reaching back. And he, you know, was trapped under kind of between the seat and the back of the car and somehow incredibly managed to call 911. You know, got through to an operator and told the operator where he was at Seven Hills and that you know he was trapped. And then she sent two officers to the school to investigate. They were on the scene for about 11 minutes and didn't find the car that Plush was in or Kyle was in that while they were there. And while they were actually on the scene, Kyle Plush called a second time to 911, kind of repeating his plea for help. And he gave a lot more specific details to on that call that he was, you know, trapped in a gold Honda Odyssey. He was at the Seven Hills Hillsdale campus, and he was really begging for his life and for them to send officers immediately. And what we've kind of learned today that Sherry found through this Cincinnati police review is that apparently that operator could not hear that second 911 call. And so that information was never relayed to officers who were actually on the scene at that time. So those officers never got those more details about where exactly Kyle was. And so the officers finished their search and marked the incident closed and went back into, you know, their daily routine. And actually a second or another Hamilton County Sheriff's deputy who was at the school normally helping with traffic as a resource officer and everything decided, you know, he ran into those cops and decided he wanted to search the lot again, but also was unable to find, you know, anyone trapped inside a car, which was kind of the message, you know, that he had received. And then, you know, about 5 hours later, one of Kyle's classmates called his parents, telling them that, you know, Kyle had never showed up for this tennis match and family called the police and then used his phone to actually track his exact location. And, you know, his father went to the school and found his son's body, which obviously is an incredibly traumatic thing to come to. But he found, you know, the car exactly where Kyle had described it, which is kind of the biggest tragedy, you know, beyond this boy losing his life is that he gave the police every single piece of information, or at least tried to, that they would need to help save him.
He did what he was supposed to do.
Exactly.
Sure.
I mean, and it's such a stressful situation, you know, to have the presence of mind to call Siri and have that, you know, phone call 911 for you and get on the line is really a remarkable thing that this kid did. And it's, you know, just obviously a tragedy that they weren't able to find him.
Sherry, you're reporting today on this issue that the 911 operator couldn't hear what he was saying.
So, you know, somebody late yesterday shared with me something called a quality assurance review report, and I'd never seen these before, and I've covered, you know, police and crime for a while. They went through this call minute by minute, supervisors over at the 911 center, to see. And this is done typically in very in difficult cases, but also as training exercises. Everybody gets 20 of them a month.
Now, is this for the first call or both calls?
everything that touched this. This is the first call, the second call, the dispatchers, when they called back, when they talked to the deputy. It is minute by minute. It's very, very intense. It is a line by line look at this. And honestly, you know, the biggest takeaway, I've listened to the calls. They haven't really been shared with the public for obvious reasons. But to know, I mean, the dispatcher said that the second dispatcher, the one who has been placed on leave, said she could not hear him. And he couldn't hear her. And so while he's pleading for his life, something went terribly wrong. And nobody's sure. We do know that the system itself was working. We have something called West Communications that runs our 911 system. They ran a diagnostics test, and the system was working just fine, they said. So was it user error? Was it fibers that come in and out of the building? Like, that is something that remains under review. But when the chief said something went terribly wrong, this is what went terribly wrong.
So you could hear the call yourself when you heard the recording of it, but the dispatcher is saying they couldn't hear it when they were hearing the call, basically.
That's correct. So okay. The 911, it's recording what he's saying.
Right.
And she can't hear him.
Has that ever happened before? I mean, how does that happen?
Well, that's the thing. I mean, definitely we have things called dropped calls many times.
Yes.
I mean, these systems are just widely reported. They've been going on for years and years with no fixes. And it'll be interesting to see if this is going to be user error or there is some failure in the actual 911 system itself somehow. Maybe it's her headset. Maybe it's the fibers that go in and out of the building.
Do we know how long till the investigation is finished?
Well, I have not ever really seen quick ones. The sheriff's office, I will say, this morning wrapped up lickety-split. They took a big look at whether their deputy did what he was supposed to do related to their policies and procedures. And this morning, you know, the chief deputy over at the sheriff's office is like, he did follow policies and procedures.
And there were three investigations, correct? There was the Cincinnati Police Department, the sheriff's office was doing their own investigation, and Prosecutor Joe Dieters is also doing an investigation.
He is.
The three that I know of.
And the mayor has suggested he's going to do some reviews himself, right, Chris?
Yeah. Well, hold the politics. Let me
right.
Let,
okay.
Right. Let me get back. We'll get to that.
Let's hold it forever.
Kate, the paper did a pretty good graphic description of what actually mm-hmm. happened inside that van. Can you describe that?
Yes. So the car that Kyle was in was a 2004 Honda Odyssey. And so in that car, there are kind of three rows of seats, the driver in the passenger seat, and then the two bucket seats in the middle. And then there's this third row that basically has the capability to be folded over frontways so that the back is kind of more flat for like storage and that kind of thing. And then there's also the capability of it to flip back the other way to kind of be tucked under into the back. And there's like a well in the back of that van. And so what seems to have happened is that Kyle had come through the back seat and was leaning over that third row and kind of reaching for, you know, his racket or his bag, his tennis gear. And that seat, you know, for some reason, whether it was, you know, it wasn't latched properly or there could have been, you know, a number of things that kind of led to this. But as he's reaching over that third row back seat, the seat flips over. And so the back kind of comes back towards the trunk, sort of that van. And he's basically pinned in between the back of that seat, which is now, you know, toppled on top of him, and kind of pinning him between that seat and the back of the van. So he's at this point upside down, and the seat is pinned against his chest, and the car kind of trapping him inside there and into that back well area where the seat could normally fold down into. And so while he's, you know, trapped there, he is struggling to breathe and, you know, eventually died from suffocation from that chest compression from the back seat is what it kind of looks like from that illustration.
Do we know if and again, your illustration is very good. It's on the Enquirer's website. Do we know if there was a recall for this? I've saw reports about that. Was this vehicle subject to a recall for that issue?
Yeah, so actually the year that this particular model was not part of that recall. That was later on. It was the same. It was still Honda Odysseys, but the year that this car was made would not have been part of that, you know, kind of widely reported recall. yeah, so that's kind of what we know about that. I don't know if Cher, if you know more.
No, that's something that we have learned. But I certainly I know that Joe Dieter's investigation is looking at this van and how this came to be. Was the seat broken? Was this something that just happened? Like, how was a latch accidentally pulled? That'll be part of what they're looking at with this van.
Chris, you tweeted out sometime last night, if you can't smell the political weaponization of this tragedy in the air, get your olfactory senses examined. Explain your tweet.
Yeah. You know, it's really, I don't know. I don't know if I'm troubled yet or not. I'm kind of waiting to see what happens. But the mayor and the city manager both issued statements last night about this incident. As everyone knows, they've been embroiled in a fight, really, over whether the city manager should stay or go. You know, the mayor noted the problems with the 911 system, and his statement suggested that they had not been fixed. The city manager also, in his own statement, said that, you know, that he had tried everything that he thought he could so far to fix this. Sherry, jump in anytime you want here.
Yeah.
That maybe, you know, he concluded his statement by saying, you know, maybe it's time to try something else. And the implication to me
was... You want me to read that? I have.
Yeah, go ahead and read it. Yeah, that'd be better than me trying to remember it.
This is the last paragraph of Harry Black's statement. We have done all we can to improve upon this operation with additional personnel and new technology. Perhaps it's time to consider alternative approaches to delivering these services.
My thought on that was that he is implying that the county should take over the 911 system from the city because the city apparently cannot fix it. And I don't know that the mayor wants that to happen or not.
Well, we went back and counted how many FYI memos Harry has sent to city council in the last 3.5 years about this call center, and there have been 11. So he has been very upfront about the problems, what he's tried to do to fix it, over and over and over again. So council cannot say that this any problem over there came as a surprise.
And this system, the manager's memo also said, and I'll give it to him, when I got here, the 911 center was a mess.
Right.
And I think it's been widely accepted that it's had problems for a long time. I know at least Councilmember Seelbach suggested turning it over to Hamilton County.
And he has suggested that before yesterday.
But, you know, that is harder. That sounds like an easy fix. The county certainly doesn't have as many problems. They also have a whole different set of calls. Mm-hmm. Our dispatch center, there's fire calls, there's police calls, and it's an urban versus rural. It's very different. I would never say don't look at something like this, but it's not like it's not been considered before. It warrants taking a look at, but I'm just telling you what the argument on the flip side is, why it really hasn't been done before, because it's such a different animal.
And I know there was what I want to say after John Cranley, or when Todd Portune became in charge of the Hamilton County Commission, they did a regional, what can we do regionally? And that was one of the items. And I believe it got shot down because of the issue of who was going to control it.
Exactly.
Was it going to be controlled by Hamilton County or the city? And I think isn't there a pay disparity that do the city 911 operators make more money? It's one or the other.
No, the county makes more money.
The county makes more than the city.
I mean, this is certainly a problem that is going to involve a lot of money. I mean, you can't just turn it over to the county and it's going to be free.
They're not going to just take the bill for it, right?
But on the flip side, if we're going to fix it ourselves, like low pay for dispatchers is not helping anybody. We have had a series of five different managers up there in a very short period of time. This is a very hard problem to fix. Somebody is going to have to come in with expertise in a large urban 911 center, and that person is not going to come cheap.
No, and also the issue of staff turnover. What do you think staff turnover is going to be like now? I mean, like these jobs are difficult. They're high stress. They don't get paid a lot. There's often mandatory overtime. And, you know, if you make a mistake, and I'm not suggesting there was one in this case, but then you're opened up to public scrutiny. And I wonder if they're going to see people quitting or fewer people applying to work in this call center.
It is something that happens after incidents like these.
And it's already an industry that they're having trouble attracting people to in the first place.
Exactly.
So
The other thing I would talk about when we talk about oversight, it's not just necessarily it should be the county or the city. You know, there really is. There's a brotherhood among police officers and firemen. And, you know, at the moment, they're brothers, the people they trust, the people they went through the academy with. You know, they're the ones on the other end of the line on both ends. And it's something that is very, very important to them and does play a role. You have to. That will be taken into consideration about any mergers or what's going on.
Just real quickly, you were talking about it needs more money. I believe, was it the Inquirer reported that the ECC budget has been cut by $400,000 in some period of time?
Yes. Yes. I mean, when we're talking about the operating budget, you know, there's been some equipment, infusions of money to equipment, although, I mean, it doesn't work that great, so I don't know. Like what that money really went for. Because, you know, Harry, we have the city manager saying, you know, we've put money into things like that. But still, the operating budget has been cut. And quite frankly, the police department's been asked to cut 6% this year, and that's part of it.
Kate, before we let you go, you had a story this week about some Miami University students who were kicked out of a sorority after using a racial slur on video. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so four students were, young women were kicked out of their sorority. They were basically singing a verse in this song, and a video of them, you know, kind of went viral among students at Miami. And the sorority really acted quickly and released a statement and kind of took immediate action when they heard about the situation and removed them from the sorority. And, you know, there hasn't been any disciplinary action, like within the school. You know, that's not something that, that has happened, and I'm not sure that I don't believe that it will, though the school has, you know, kind of condemned that behavior and obviously has been making a lot of efforts recently to, I guess, create awareness around, you know, this sort of hate speech and different kind of the racial climate that a lot of students are complaining about. There's, you know, the incident kind of comes on the heels of this new black student movement on campus called the Black Action Movement 2.0. There have been several protests recently. They sent a list of demands to the university and have met with administrators. That was kind of spurred by a few other recent racist incidents by students that kind of circulated on social media. And so, you know, the university is really taking this issue seriously, and they are, you know, administrators are meeting with these students and this movement. They are really have actually already met some of the demands that were in that list. And I think that they're, you know, really trying to take a constructive look at what they can do institutionally to make these students feel more safe and comfortable on campus, which, you know, the students have said this is kind of like a daily thing that they are experiencing with other students, kind of with, you know, saying inappropriate things. And it's interesting to see how these students are really taking a strong stance against this and going to the administration with their concerns. And kind of this most recent incident is just one of those things that students are saying is kind of normal on that campus.
Cincinnati Inquirer reporter Kate Murphy, thanks for joining us this afternoon.
Yeah, thanks. Again.
Well, Sherry, let's talk about City Manager Harry Black's review. The Inquirer filed a lawsuit this week about the process and that it shouldn't be closed to the public. Tell us about that.
Yeah, no, I can't even believe anyone suggested it should be. I mean, I do understand the point of, like, you know, what's going on is that, of course, the mayor has asked the city manager to resign. That hasn't happened. And the mayor is intending to prove a pattern of unprofessional behavior. And to do that, you know, employees have to come forward and really talk about things they've seen. This is very difficult for them. I will not make light of that. I understand how difficult that is. So they designed a process in which Councilman David Mann and Councilwoman Tamaya Denard, on kind of different sides of the issue about whether he should do this, are going to hear all of this testimony and oversee this process. And then at some time at a later date, they'll allow people to see a transcript of this. The Inquirer does believe that all things at City Hall under the charter say that it needs to be done in a public and transparent way. And so while we understand, you know, their reasoning, public transparency trumps everything inside City Hall.
And this goes back to an original Inquirer lawsuit many years ago where City Council used to have executive or closed sessions using state law. And the Inquirer sued and said, no, the charter doesn't give you that right to have closed session. So since then, there have been no executive or closed meetings of City Council after your lawsuit, I believe it was in the 90s.
Yes. I mean, it's held people accountable since then. And that's an important part of what we're doing in the city. And, you know, everyone does say they like to be transparent, all of the elected officials. And so this is just a
reminder.
What's
the time frame on the
I was just getting ready to ask if we heard anything.
So it's my understanding that it's probably going to be heard on Monday. I'm not sure if it's just going to be written or oral arguments, but it is something that's on Monday. But both sides do understand that the hearings are supposed to start on Monday. Both sides do understand that that's really an impossibility if a judge has not ruled yet. And they're just like, we'll delay it if it comes to that. And don't forget, anyway, things are unfolding very quickly in City Hall on Monday with the special counsel meeting and a very long law.
But they haven't still decided the issue of if the city's going to pay for Harry Black's attorney either. That's still out there.
The solicitor said that the council would need to make an appropriation. I haven't seen
anything. There's been nothing. Yeah. I mean, so that's still hanging out there.
But that could come through budget committee on Monday, I suppose, right? Spending.
The interesting thing to me about the Inquirer's lawsuit is it hinges on whether or not this constitutes a city proceeding. Like, two members of council don't need to declare a public meeting in order to meet with each other and somebody else. But if it's a quote-unquote official proceeding, I suppose they do.
That leads into a question I was getting ready to ask next. That's not the only lawsuit that was filed this week. There was another lawsuit that was filed alleging that five council members had an illegal email text exchange coming up with their statement that was issued, I believe, on March the 16th about this whole process to start with. Tell us about that.
Well, the coalition – what is it? The coalition opposed to
additional spending and taxes.
Yeah, thank you. It's a political organization that opposes taxes and spending, or additional taxes and spending. And they feel that the five Democrats who kind of have taken control of this Harry Black situation acted illegally in exchanging these texts. And I think really, though, what happened was there were four people in the texts, and there was one person in – or I'm sorry. There was one – there's like maybe a phone meeting that happened, and then there was somebody on a text in Europe or something, or in Israel. And so anyway.
It's a string of five people talking by text.
Yeah.
It's a classic round robin text.
I don't even think it was round robin at this point. It was just a conversation. But the truth of the matter is there were two people out of the country, one on vacation, one for work. And so I think it would have probably happened in a round robin way inside City Hall.
Yeah.
But doesn't this circle back through to the Inquirer's lawsuit again? Can two council members meet together?
Absolutely.
Without it being considered.
Absolutely they can.
Can five make a decision on public policy outside of public view?
Not all at the same time. Definitely not all at the same time.
That is what that lawsuit alleges from this outside attorney, Brian Shrive. So he is alleging that they basically were setting policy in this conversation.
Right.
But I've done this for 20 plus years. If anyone thinks they're going to stop that, it's gone on for ages.
No, he's just bringing attention to it, and he's going to have the city pay his legal bills. So that's, another $30,000, $40,000. I mean, he's trying to make a point. That's what he's doing is, bringing attention to what all of us see on a daily basis at City Hall.
The interesting thing to me is to see what the solicitor tells the council members that they have to do. The solicitor is very close to the mayor, and the mayor doesn't. He really wishes they would just sign off on the severance agreement for Harry. So I think it's be interesting to see what she says that they need to do. Maybe they'll turn these over, and this lawsuit will get settled. But if you make them turn over these text messages, I think that opens up a really interesting can of worms, because everybody at City Hall uses their phone in this way, and
their phones.
And their personal email, and no one has really pressed them on that before. So it'll be interesting to see what kind of outcome there is legally.
And the dispute specifically about text messages, if they are public records, there's a real divide. City Hall does not believe they are a public record, and many of us disagree with
they
that.
They are public record.
Yeah. Well, not according to the city solicitor.
Let me get to two more things here before we completely run out of time. Sherry, Jesse Jackson was in town this week.
He was.
Tell us about his visit in about 30 to 40 seconds.
You know, he came. He really is taking a stand against Kroger. You know, Kroger has closed some low-performing stores, and it's affecting, you know, minority communities. And he wants a boycott of Kroger, which, of course, is based here. And so he came to town for that. But, you know, he knows this city. He knows some of our city officials, and he wasn't afraid to wade into issues of the city. He took on soccer in the West End, saying he wasn't sure that was the right fit and they should really take some more caution. And he weighed in on the Harry Black situation. There was like a series. I mean, I talked to him and wrote a story. There was radio appearances. And so he made a day of it. But the primary focus was that he really is trying to take Kroger to task for closing. You know, it's a business. Underperforming stores, but yet they are creating food deserts, and so it's really a food desert issue he was taking on.
And Paul, I'll give the last word to you, the last topic. We had some news this week from Hamilton County Commissioner Todd Portoon.
And that what a wonderful, strong man he is, and what he has overcome already in his life, and he will have his left leg amputated on Monday because of cancer. And he's even making light of that perhaps, you know, he'll be able to walk better now with a prosthetic. And he's vowing to come right back to work.
And I think even vowing perhaps to work on commission stuff as soon as he comes out of recovery on
Monday. He's really such an inspiring man.
Thank you all for being here. My guest, WCPO.com, WCPO Politics, Insider Politics and Government reporter Paula Christian, Cincinnati Enquirer City Hall reporter Sharon Coolidge, and Cincinnati Business Courier staff reporter and columnist Chris Wetterich. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Archives of our programs are available on our website, wvxu.org. Today's program was produced by Pete Reitmeier. The assistant producer is Selena Reeder. Technical director was Josh Elstra. William White composed the Cincinnati Edition theme music. I'm Jay Hanselman filling in today for Dan Hurley. Have a great weekend. This is 91.7 WVXU.